The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. Today we're looking at some ways that not knowing things affects the pursuit of science and life in general. A little later, I'm joined by Stuart Feierstein, chair of Columbia University's Department of Biological Sciences, to talk about his book, Ignorance, How It Drives Science. But first, let's learn a bit about the laws designed to protect consumers from dangerous or ineffective medical treatments. I'm here with Adam Wygodny, a lawyer practicing commercial litigation and competition law in Toronto at the firm of Burko Cohen. Before studying law, Adam earned his MA in public policy and public administration. Welcome to the show, Adam.
Thank you, Desiree. It's good to be here.
Now, before we get going, we do need to point out a couple of things about what Adam is and is not here to do. So you are not here representing anyone in particular, right?
That is correct. Any opinions that are expressed are my own personal opinion and do not represent those of my employer or any clients or associations with which I may be affiliated.
I should note that you're actually not here to give anyone legal advice, so don't put legal questions in the comment section of our website for this show.
Thank you.
So the first thing I wanted to talk about was the history of consumer protection laws.
Initially, within common law jurisdictions, the remedies that were available to consumers were limited to those under the law of contract. One of the limitations of that is that it required that a contract exist between the consumer who may have been harmed by the product and the manufacturer that manufactured the product. Or, in certain circumstances, the retailer, if the retailer was in a position to detect the potential harm and take steps to avert it. In the common law, a significant development occurred in the 1930s in the case of Donahue and Stevenson, which is also known as the case of the Paisley Snail. Ms. Donahue had met a friend at a cafe, and a bottle of ginger beer had been purchased, but not by Ms. Donahue. The bottle was brought to the table, and it was a dark, opaque bottle, and one could not see inside the bottle. Ginger beer was poured out from the bottle. Ms. Donahue consumed the ginger beer and subsequently discovered the remnants of a snail that had been packaged inside the ginger beer, grew ill, and sued the manufacturer. Initially, the manufacturer, Stevenson, sought to have the case thrown out as showing no cause of action. Eventually, it made it all the way to the House of Lords, and the House of Lords decided that indeed the manufacturer owed Miss Stevenson a duty of care, and that in a modern industrial society, one's neighbor is not necessarily someone who's in close physical proximity, but may in fact be someone whose proximity arises through technology at its essence. Prior to industrialization, it's unlikely that Miss Donahue would have been purchasing ginger beer commercially, or that ginger beer would have been manufactured commercially and shipped to the cafe that Miss Stevenson arrived at via tram for an afternoon of ginger beer and ice cream. So that caused a fundamental change in the common law, and it expanded greatly the basis of liability that manufacturers could be exposed to by virtue of their products. However, that still required that physical or actual harm occur to the consumer.
Right.
It didn't address a number of issues, such as misleading sales practices or what would be considered unfair contractual agreements with terms that are either not brought to the attention of the consumer or couched in such a way that your typical consumer would not understand the implication of what they were agreeing to. So more recently, you've seen consumer protection legislation passed in all of the provinces of Canada. And the purpose of that was to fill in the gaps left by both the common law and federal statutes such as the Competition Act and the Trademarks Act.
Now that's in Canada. Is it similar in the US?
You have a similar pattern in the US. The statutes are different, although in terms of alternative health, you have a similar breakdown in terms of the jurisdiction. So with respect to the products, much of the legislation and regulation occurs at the federal level, but with respect to practitioners, that typically occurs at the state or the provincial level. Notwithstanding the attempts of government to patch the holes that were existing in the law, there was still a fundamental economic problem. For most consumers, it simply was not cost effective for them to sue, and unless they were seriously harmed, for example, in the case of negligently manufactured automobiles, medical devices, and other such products. But for many consumer transactions, manufacturers could get away with harming a large number of people, but by just a little bit at a time. To resolve those issues, you saw the development of class action legislation.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking to Toronto attorney Adam Wygodny about consumer protection regulation and how it tries to protect us from dubious medical claims. Now, one of the sort of, I guess, spheres of alternative medicine that's come under fire recently is homeopathy. Speaking about this before the show with you, there's actually four major cases going on against providers of homeopathy, and that's just in North America. So maybe tell us a little bit about them, starting with Gallucci.
The Gallucci case has a tentative settlement agreement. It's seeking to certify a class that goes back approximately 10 years and would cover all of the products manufactured by the French homeopathic manufacturer Boiron that are sold in the United States, with the exception of those products that are covered under another American class action, which is the case of Gonzalez and Boiron. The third case in the U.S. is De La Rosa and Boiron. Now, the framework that's been put forward in the Gallucci case would be a settlement in the amount of $5 million. And as I stated earlier, this would cover all of the manufacturer's products sold in the U.S., excepting those that would be covered by the Gonzalez case. The Gonzalez case is limited to a single product purchased by persons in California over the past 4 years. $5 million represents approximately 18% of Boiron's revenue in the United States for the last fiscal year that they've reported, which seems a bit low when you consider that they're seeking to cover all of their products going back approximately a decade. Whether this will be accepted by the judge at the fairness hearing, I don't know.
So what are these cases actually about?
All of the cases are at their heart alleging that there have been false and misleading representations on the packaging and marketing of the products at issue. Now, none of these allegations have been proven in court. The certification phase is merely to determine whether the proceeding should continue as a class action or not. So what'll often occur would be the manufacturer would oppose certification because it would prefer to be in a position where each individual would have to file their own claim, which is simply not cost effective from the plaintiff's perspective. And in order to do that, they will generally want to show that the basis of the claim is something subjective to the individual, right? And therefore it cannot be resolved on a class-wide basis.
Well, now, so this is the same, basically the same situation as with the Buron Shoppers proceedings?
Correct. Now, that proceeding's been commenced in Ontario, although it seeks certification of its claim on a Canada-wide basis. In that case, the allegations are that Osilicokinum and the children's version of that product have been marketed by way of false and misleading representations on the packaging and I believe on the website for the manufacturer, and that the retailer has been complicit in this in presenting the product to the public. Specifically, the allegations are based on the Competition Act, which creates a civil remedy in the case of false and misleading representations used in furthering any business interest. And allegations under each of the provinces' consumer protection legislation. And in addition, there's also an allegation that the product is being marketed contrary to the Weights and Measures Act, which is a piece of federal legislation that sets out the units of measure that must be used in marketing a product. And specifically, the allegation is that the use of homeopathic nomenclature to identify the quantity of the ingredient is contrary to that legislation.
Interesting. So just to be clear then, so everyone knows what we're talking about, these lawsuits, all of them are basically asking the courts to decide if homeopathy actually works or not?
Not necessarily. For example, in the Ontario proceeding, the allegations include, one, that the ingredient identified as the medicinal ingredient is not medicinal.
Right.
So there you would be getting into issues of efficacy. But it also alleges that the ingredient identified as the medicinal ingredient is not, in fact, an ingredient in the product.
So how will they come to a decision about that?
If it were to go to trial, the plaintiff always has the burden of proving their claim. This is speculative, but I would expect that there would be expert evidence put in to speak to what does the scientific literature say when it was tested as a medicine. You could also expect to see expert reports as to the composition of the actual product. So if the product's claiming that it contains a medicinal ingredient, there should be some evidence of the medicinal ingredient. For example, if you were to analyze the product and you were to find that it only contained sugar and certainly not extract of Barbary, duck, heart, and liver, then the judge will say, oh, well, that's interesting. Their tests show that there is none of this ingredient in it. What do you have to say about that?
Well, okay, so this sounds awesome, is all I have to say. So how likely is this to go to court then?
With respect to where the Ontario proceeding stands currently, the case has been assigned to a class certification judge. The next step is that there will be a case conference with counsel for the plaintiff and counsel for the defendants to set out a schedule for the certification proceeding. And depending on the outcome of the certification proceeding, the next issue would be discoveries. So documentary discovery, whereby the parties have to disclose and, if requested, produce copies of all relevant documents that are in their possession, followed by, in Canada, they're called examinations for discovery. In the US, they use the term depositions, right, where you get to ask questions of the other party.
So what we're saying is hopefully, hopefully?
A few years, realistically.
Oh, okay.
I mean, the reality is, at least in Ontario, things do not move all that quickly through the courts generally. There are certain exceptions, but class proceedings do not fall in those exceptions because they tend to feature large amounts of money, both in terms of the amounts being claimed and the costs that are involved in both prosecuting and defending the proceeding. All parties tend to be very cautious and want to make sure that everything is done correctly and no stone is left uncovered before you move to the next stage.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking to Toronto attorney Adam Wygodny about consumer protection regulation and, at this moment, homeopathy. Okay, so let's say you win. We win. What does that do? What does that mean?
Well, firstly, just to clarify in terms of who would win, it would be the class members who win, because that's really who the proceeding is about. Whether that would be the end of homeopathy, I suspect not. At least in Ontario, at the provincial level, and as well as in a number of the other provinces of Canada, you now have legislation in place to eventually make homeopaths a self-regulating profession. From a skeptical perspective, you can look at that two ways. It's incredibly problematic because it grants an air of legitimacy to a modality where the evidence simply doesn't support it having efficacy. The other issue that arises with that from a legal perspective in terms of consumer protection is that in the common law, if you have a regulated profession and someone is alleging that that person acted negligently, the general rule is that only another member of that profession can provide the evidence as to what the standard of care is. The issue in having homeopaths deciding whether another homeopath has been negligent, in my view, is highly problematic, simply because, in my opinion, to believe in homeopathy requires either a level of delusion, ignorance, or simply fraud. So what sort of standard of care is going to come out of such a group? The other side, though, is that, one, if it's a regulated health profession, then, at least in Ontario, there's a piece of legislation called the Healthcare Consent Act. And under the Healthcare Consent Act, you're required, as a healthcare professional that's governed by that act, to obtain informed consent, which in the case of homeopathy is again problematic, as there's a good argument to be made that to provide informed consent, they would have to tell their patients/customers that when their treatments have been tested, they have not been shown to be efficacious, that the evidence indicates that it does not perform better than a placebo, and so on, etc. Along those same lines, as a regulated profession, they would also be required to carry insurance. So depending on the number of claims that end up filed against homeopaths, the insurer may effectively serve as a regulatory mechanism by pricing the required insurance at a price that's, you know, too high for many homeopaths to continue operating profitably.
Okay, so one last question. If somebody wants to get in on this class action action, what can they do?
Well, if they have a claim or they know someone who has a claim, they should get in touch with plaintiff's counsel. In terms of what the skeptical community can do, it would be in identifying products that are making representations that you believe are false or misleading, particularly if there's a potential for harm to people, and let counsel know. Most lawyers are not trained in science, and most lawyers, while they might be trained to think skeptically, would not necessarily be tuned into the skeptic community, which has done an excellent job at identifying products in the past. So there's homeopathy, there's in Australia, the skeptic groups there identified the power balance band, and the company was sued in Australia, and then they were sued in the United States, which in those cases bankrupted the company. So those are some of the things that skeptics can do, as well as translating scientific literature into media that's easily digested by lay people.
Adam, that was great. Very good overview. Thanks so much for being here.
Oh, you're welcome.
You'll find a link to the cases that Adam mentioned on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be right back with biologist Stuart Firestein to talk about his book, Ignorance, How It Drives Science, right after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm joined today by Dr. Stuart Firestein, the chair of Columbia University's Department of Biological Sciences, where he studies the vertebrate olfactory system. Dedicated to promoting the accessibility of science to a public audience, Firestein serves as an advisor for the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation's Program for the Public Understanding of Science. He's here to talk about his book, Ignorance, How It Drives Science. Welcome to the show, Stuart.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here, Desiree.
So what is the premise of this book, sir?
Well, the premise comes really from a class that I teach, believe it or not, here at Columbia University, which is called Ignorance. And I must say, I guess I make the university quite proud to have a course called Ignorance now listed in the bulletin. But the course was based on the idea that we were teaching science in a way that was maybe too much based on fact, that students were being taught science in courses that were just loaded with facts and big textbooks. And indeed, I think this is the view that the public has of science now as well, that it's primarily some sort of a large collection, accumulation of facts, a huge edifice that's almost impregnable for most of us. But that's not the way scientists think of it. When we go to meetings and go out for a beer afterwards or this or that, we really never talk to each other about what we know. We only talk about what we don't know, because that's really what we care about. And that's what gets us in early in the morning and keeps us there late at night.
So then would you say that science isn't really about what is known? It's more about what is unknown then?
Well, I think that's what at least moves science forward. And that's what we mostly spend our time doing when those of us who are scientists do science, and it's what we spend most of our time thinking about. Now, that's not to say, of course, the facts aren't of some importance. That's what we do. We get data. We do our best to come up with facts and so forth. But I think most scientists would agree with me if I said that really the facts are the most unreliable part of the whole operation. We all know that whatever seems like a fact today or a finding today will be, if not overturned, at least revised in some way, altered, expanded, changed by the next generation of scientists with the next generation of tools. And so really the facts are the most changeable thing in the whole operation.
Well, so if it isn't about facts, but people think it's about facts, then is this detrimental, that perception of science?
Well, I think it is, and so of course I use the word ignorance to be intentionally provocative here a little bit, and I don't mean the kinds of ignorance that's just sort of amounts to stupidity or even worse than that, a kind of willful stupidity. I mean what was best said, I think, by a physicist named James Clerk Maxwell in the 19th century, probably the best physicist, the greatest physicist between Newton and Einstein, who said that the prelude to every great discovery in science is thoroughly conscious ignorance. And it's this idea of thoroughly conscious ignorance that I think is the keystone to understanding science. And what's detrimental about thinking of science as a what I call the accumulation model of science that's current today, which means that it's just this continuous accumulation of fact and data and data and so much of it that no one person could hope to know even a small percentage of it. The detrimental part of that is that I think it leaves the public feeling that they have no purchase on it, no traction with science, except what they get told in the newspaper or here or there, that if you don't have a PhD or two, you have no hope of ever becoming part of that adventure. And that's not the case.
So how are you defining ignorance?
Well, I define ignorance, as I say, along the lines of James Clerk Maxwell saying thoroughly conscious ignorance.
So what does that mean?
Well, it means that when you do get facts, when you do get answers, when you do ask questions and you do experiments, the purpose really is to better define what we don't know, to better define the ignorance that's left, to ask better questions. That getting an answer is not the end point, but rather it should be a starting point. It should be a place where we can go beyond the answer to the next set of questions that we maybe couldn't have even known existed before we got that data. Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense at one time, famously said it's not just the known unknowns that we have to worry about, it's the unknown unknowns, the things that we don't even know we don't know yet. And that's where I think science is really, that's where it works.
You're tuned in to Skeptically Speaking, and my guest today is Stuart Feierstein, the chair of Columbia University's Department of Biological Sciences and the author of Ignorance, How It Drives Science. So it seems like then questions are more important than answers.
Well, I would say so. Of course, good questions and knowing how to pose good questions. Anybody can sort of memorize a bunch of facts, I suppose, even if there are a lot of them. But to try and frame a question is a different story. I think, for example, there's several images that abound in science, that or the way people think science works. And I think they're not entirely wrong, but they don't quite catch it the way it should be. For example, the notion that scientists are sort of patiently piecing together some big puzzle and putting one piece in after another. That's very nice, but it's not really true. I mean, with puzzles, of course, the manufacturer is guaranteed that there's a solution. We don't really work that way. We have no idea if there's truly a solution, or indeed if there was a manufacturer, if you will. Another example, I guess, that's common is the idea of an onion, you know, that science is unraveling the layers of an onion to get to some fundamental deep truth, or perhaps the famous iceberg idea that all we see is the tip of the iceberg, that most of what's there is unknown to us or not visible to us. And these images are all a little bit correct, but the problem is I think they're too static, shall I say. They give you the impression that you just keep chipping away, we'll get somewhere, that will be an advance. And I see science more, the image that I prefer, if you'll pardon the poetic side of this a little bit, is that science is like sort of ripples on a pond. And if you think of the knowledge as the growing size of the circle, then it's also true that the circumference of that circle, of that growing circle, is also growing. And that's the part that's in touch with that sea of ignorance outside of it. So that as knowledge grows, so in fact does ignorance. So in fact does our knowledge of ignorance. And that's really where science is occurring, on the edge of that ripple.
We have a question from the chat from Greg Layden.
So learning and investigation is a process, and ignorance is derailing that process?
No, I think they belong together. I'm not sure I would go for the word derailing there. I think ignorance is a way of directing that process. Ignorance is the way we get beyond the simple fact or beyond the simple investigation and try and figure out what the more fundamental question is. So we begin with a question, and the trick is to get to a better question, not just to an answer. Answers are often kind of the end of the line, or the end of the story. It's been interesting, the recent excitement about this Higgs boson discovery at CERN, and several physicists have expressed the notion that although this is a wonderful discovery and extremely important, it's really just the beginning. It's not an answer, and if it were an answer, it would be rather disappointing because it would be the end of the conversation, you know, it would be the end of the interesting work. But really, it's just the beginning. It's a new answer, but it opens up a whole host of questions that were unavailable to us before. So the best answers are the ones that generate more questions.
Well, you also said in the book that one of the issues is that facts aren't always correct, but the really successful ones stick around regardless, like the idea of the tongue map.
So there are unfortunately way too many examples of things that get into the scientific literature and then into the popular literature as well that seem to be fact, but really they're not. And if you look carefully at them, you realize that either the citation for this, the source of it, was either unreliable to begin with or can't even be found any longer. One of the more famous ones that I'm most aware of is this idea of the tongue map, because my laboratory studies both taste and smell. And so we've been aware of this for a long time. And that's this notion that you will find published in textbooks everywhere, including medical textbooks and graduate textbooks, as well as high school science textbooks, that your tongue has areas of sensitivity that are mapped onto it, such that sweet things you taste with the tip of your tongue and salty and sour things on the sides of your tongue and bitter at the back. And that's a complete falsehood. Turns out to be the result of a mistranslation of a very, very anecdotal report by a German physiologist in the early 1900s, around 1902, who just happened to mention that he and a few of his students were messing around with this and noticed that their tongues were slightly more sensitive to this, that, or the other thing in different places. And it got picked up somehow as a mistranslation, as it being an actual experiment. And then it got published in a few textbooks, and I guess there's some appeal to it. I don't know what exactly, but it's virtually become a fact, except it's not true.
I love that because I had no idea before I read the book.
I'm really sorry to dispel this myth this way, but it's just
I wasn't wedded to it. It's fine.
Yeah.
But you touched on this earlier, that answers and facts are still important. And I really do want to clarify that, because that's how ideally we decide truth from fiction and how we develop opinions and positions. And facts are fairly vital to that.
There is, I think, a potential danger in my overstating the idea that ignorance is more important than fact or data in science. It's not. I'm just trying. It's just that it's become so unbalanced in favor of facts over the last few years. I may be overdoing it slightly. But so certainly there are facts, and certainly there are some reliable facts. And even those that are not entirely reliable don't necessarily become untrue. I mean, such as, say, Newton's laws of force and gravity, don't become untrue when Einstein redefines our ideas about gravity with his relativistic explanations. Within the regime that Newton worked, they were true, and they are still true within that regime, which is a context that allows us to build bridges and launch rockets and things like that. But it's also true that they're not completely correct, that they needed to be extended and expanded by Einstein's idea about relativity. So, for example, although we can build bridges and run automobiles and things like that, many kinds of machines, and do all sorts of work with Newton's few laws of mass and gravity, you couldn't run a GPS system or a cell phone with that. You need relativistic physics in order to make those work.
Well, now let's talk about how sort of this is applied, because you wrote about the way that scientific studies are designed to foster ignorance and therefore reduce bias, like the double-blind study.
Right. So I guess maybe what you're referring to is my tirade somewhere through in the middle of the book against
hypotheses. I wouldn't have called it that.
Well, There are people who call it a tirade, fair. Trust me. Even I think of it as a little bit of one. And again, I think it's only necessary because the balance has gone the opposite way. So I think people have this notion, again, that science progresses in this very orderly way, that we have rules by which we proceed. We have this thing called the scientific method, where we have a hypothesis, and then we try some experiments, then we revise the hypothesis. And I don't know anybody who uses this method, really. This so-called scientific method, it's a kind of an idealized statement maybe of how things might go. But really, the way I think science should be described is by an ancient adage, which I think I start the book with this quote. It's an old proverb which says it's very difficult to find a black cat in a dark room, especially when there's no cat. And to me, this is precisely how science works. I mean, we bumble around in dark rooms looking for these black cats that have been sort of reported to be in there, but it's not clear how reliable the report is. And then at some point, there's enough fumbling and bumbling around that we get some ideas about what the room looks like, where the cat might be. Somebody switches on a light and, oh, we say, that's how it really looks, you know, because we found some light switch. Suddenly it becomes apparent. But the first thing we all do is just run off into the next dark room. I mean, nobody hangs around in there. Now that you know it, that's it. You know it, you know. But it is important to realize, I think, that just because science, as I say, I think is constructed on ignorance, the doing of science is constructed on ignorance, that doesn't mean that it's unreliable. So I think there's an unfortunate misuse of this notion where ignorance is equated with doubt and doubt is equated with uncertainty. And that's all okay. I think that's all true of science. We do have doubts about it. We do find some things uncertain. But that doesn't mean that it's unreliable. As I say, when we do find a fact, it's often a pretty reasonable approximation of the real fact, although it may need a little bit of revision. But it's still a valuable idea and a valuable fact. And so it shouldn't be taken that science is in some way unreliable. In fact, it still is, in my opinion, and I think in the opinion of many people, the single best way of knowing about the world we live in and the universe around us.
There's an important point in there that our own certainty really gets in the way sometimes.
Oh yeah, this is one of the more disastrous problems, of course, and it doesn't. This is where my, as my earlier referred to, tirade against hypotheses starts out. Because I think that the notion of a hypothesis has a certain amount of danger in science. It's been overstressed in funny ways, which I'll talk about in just a moment. But the problem that I have with a hypothesis is that it usually starts out being somebody's sort of best idea about how things might work. And so, like any idea that you have, you become kind of invested in it. And that investment in an idea that at this point is just a speculation, I think has the potential of creating all kinds of biases, conscious and unconscious. So you begin to think of experiments that are likely to prove the hypothesis, even though you're told that the correct thing is to think of the experiments that will disprove it. Nobody does that. Nobody wants to be wrong, let's face it. And then you begin selecting data in unconscious ways. You begin selecting the data that seem to support the hypothesis rather than data that don't support it or go against it. And so I think it's potentially a very dangerous thing, a place where you introduce bias. The other big problem with the hypothesis is that it's been taken up, at least in America and many other places that follow our kind of Western science, to be the key to science. And so funding agencies in particular always insist that your grant proposal follow what's called hypothesis-driven research. You're always supposed to be proposing a hypothesis and then some strategy for testing it. So the worst criticism you can get from a funding agency is that, well, what you've handed in here is just curiosity-driven research. And I think to myself, really? Isn't that the idea? Or that it's just a fishing expedition. And I think that's exactly what science is about. It's fishing expeditions. Now, to the extent that you have a good idea where to put your line in the water, that's all to the better. But finally, none of us is smart enough to know beforehand what we're going to get. And if you do know beforehand what you're going to get, you can be sure that'll screw the experiment up.
We have a question from Karen.
How do you square the continuous questioning process of science with the very human need for certainty and security? Can those things coexist?
So this is, I think, one of the biggest problems we face now, and we see it in these sort of politicized issues like climate control. We saw it, for those of us who are old enough to remember, that the tobacco wars that went on for years as to whether there was or was not a health hazard in tobacco, which we all knew there was. And now we see it, as I say, in climate control issues, in stem cell issues, in genetically modified crops, and all of these sorts of things. Erwin Schrödinger, who was a brilliant physicist in the 1940s, said that in any honest pursuit of knowledge, one has to be willing to abide by ignorance for an indefinite period of time. But that is, as the writer said, an extremely difficult thing for human beings to do. Our brains are just not set up for uncertainty and for doubt and for abiding by ignorance. It's a nice prescription, but it's very hard to do in practice. I always use the example of what are called ambiguous figures. These are visual illusions that I'm sure most people are familiar with. You've seen them all over the place. There's the famous one is called the Necker cube, which is a three-dimensional cube, a line drawing of a three-dimensional cube, which when you, as you look at it, it flips back and forth between coming out of the page at you and going into the page away from you, or the two Greek vases that are white but seem to then have a black silhouette between them, or there's a famous one of a beautiful young woman looking away from you, but if you look at it a slightly different way, it's the profile of an old woman. So there are many of these sort of what we call ambiguous figures. And I guess the art of M.C. Escher, which many people are familiar with, is built on this too. So that you can look at a drawing or a figure and interpret it either one of two ways. But the key observation is that your brain never sees the transition. It never sees both ways at once. And it flips instantaneously from one to the other. You never see a transitional figure in between. And so that's the problem. I mean, we don't like doubt and uncertainty. We make a quick interpretation. It's either the cube is either coming in or going out, but it can't be in the middle and it can't be doing both. And so this is, I agree, a problem. I mean, that works if you're a nomad in the savannah and you don't want to mistake a leopard spots for the dappled sunlight in the trees or a nice tasty brown rabbit in the grass for something else. So you make quick decisions and you don't have any uncertainty. But in a modern technological world such as we live in now, it creates quite a large number of difficulties.
We'll be right back to talk more with Dr. Stuart Firestein, author of Ignorance, How It Drives Science, after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're looking at the ways that evolution might influence our modern lives, from obesity to overpopulation to heavy metal music. We spend the hour with Rob Brooks, professor of evolution and director of the Evolution and Ecology Research Center at the University of New South Wales. He'll join us to talk about his book, Sex, Genes, and Rock and Roll, How Evolution Has Shaped the Modern World. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and I'm here with Dr. Stuart Firestein, the chair of Columbia University's Department of Biological Sciences, advisor for the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation's Program for the Public Understanding of Science, and author of Ignorance, How It Drives Science. So how else does science use ignorance, Stuart?
I think it uses it in an almost daily way to, as I say, progress. One of my favorite quotes is from George Bernard Shaw, who in a famous toast to Albert Einstein, he was at a dinner feting Einstein for something or another, I guess, and his toast was that science is always wrong. It never gets one answer without creating 10 new questions. And I find that glorious. I mean, I think that's exactly the way it should work, of course.
There were three that you mentioned in the book that I very much liked, and I thought that really summed it all up. Prove others wrong, prove themselves wrong, and fuel scientific goals.
So that's exactly right. I mean, this is what scientists wind up doing. The wonderful thing about science, of course, is that it's open to revision. In fact, for science, revision is a victory. We consider this a triumph when something that was thought to be true turns out to be slightly different and we revise it. This is, in my mind, if you will, what differentiates science from other kinds of belief systems, anything from, if you will, astrology to organized religion, where revision is not a victory at all. And indeed, it's kind of an embarrassment, right? I mean, you shouldn't have to revise something that's been handed down from on high or that should be known by a priesthood or something. So to me, this is why you should trust science, that we should have confidence in science, precisely because it's so prepared to be revised.
So how about proving themselves wrong?
Well, there's even a certain pleasure in that. I mean, I have to say, this is So, of course, there's always great pleasure in proving somebody else wrong. Do an experiment, you can say, well, they were close, but they didn't quite see this or that. But even proving yourself wrong at an earlier time has a certain kind of funny pleasure to it. I mean, because now you're getting it a little more correct, a little righter. I often tell students that if they're looking for really interesting questions to pursue in the lab, they really, I mean, of course, they should read the current literature because it's important to stay current. But really, to search for questions, the best place to look is in the literature of papers that were published 10 or 15 years ago in top journals that were really important papers. But because in the ensuing 15 years, we have new tools and new things have come up, we can go back and find unanswered questions in those papers. It's not so much that we would go prove them wrong, but be able to extend the ideas that were there that people didn't even know existed when they wrote those papers.
Now, as to fueling scientific goals, we have an audience question about that. This is Kelly.
Does the willful ignorance that some groups maintain about certain topics ever influence the direction of research in some areas of science?
Well, I hope not. You know, willful ignorance is not the kind of ignorance that I'm talking about. I hope most scientists avoid that sort of willful ignorance. I'm not sure whether the writer was referring to the sort of politicization of science that comes from some groups that insist on a willful ignorance, such as, you know, creationists and things of that nature, intelligent design types. And again, I guess that could influence some scientists, people who feel that it's so necessary to answer them that they'll do experiments or gear their research towards trying to prove intelligent design or creationist ideas wrong. But personally, I think that's probably a losing battle.
You use a few case studies in your book to illustrate the kind of ignorance that you're talking about, the effective use of ignorance. And I love stories. So maybe you could tell us about the studies done on animal consciousness. That was fascinating.
So that's among my favorites. So the idea of the class that the book is based on, the way I run the class, is that on intermittent weeks, typically 8 or 9 times during the course of a semester, the class meets once a week, we invite in a scientist, a working scientist, who will tell us what it is he or she doesn't know and would like to know, and why they've chosen this question versus that question, and so forth and so on. And I try and make these what I call case histories in ignorance. So it's not that I want people to come in and tell us what the big questions are, like how did the universe begin, or what is consciousness, or things of that nature. I think those are handled perfectly well, I suppose, by TV shows like, you know, Nature and Nova and things
right.
like that. So the idea is to get a scientist to really talk to us in detail about what are the individual questions they're working on. And I find one of the most interesting, of course, is, I mean, if you're looking for ignorance, if you're looking for what you can't know, as I say in this chapter, the one thing that none of us, I suppose, really can ever know is whether when I say red, it means the same thing as what you think of as red. And that's difficult enough. But then even to go a step further is to try and imagine what's in the mind of another animal. One of the researchers who I had in early on and who I profile in the book is a woman named Diana Reese, who works with dolphins and also elephants. And just for full disclosure, I have to say she happens to be my wife, but I would not hold her responsible for that. Everybody makes a mistake here and there in their life. But she happened to do the class one time, and I knew the story well, and I thought it was such an interesting story. What's so interesting about, I think, her work is that she sets experiments up to give animals such as dolphins or elephants, the two creatures she works with the most, to give them an opportunity to tell us something about them. So without starting with some preconceived idea or a set of sort of operant conditioning tests or things like that, she tries to provide them with opportunities so that we can catch a glimpse of what might be going on in their minds, because we think something's going on in their minds, but who knows what it is. I guess she's most famous for having shown that dolphins and more recently elephants are both capable of recognizing themselves in a mirror. And these were the first two non-primate species in which this so-called mirror self-recognition has been shown to exist. And she's also shown that it doesn't exist in many other species who are quite smart. I mean, dogs and cats, we all have, those of us who have dogs and cats think they're quite smart, and they are quite smart, and as are monkeys for that matter. But even monkeys or dogs or cats never quite get the mirror thing the way a chimpanzee or a gorilla or a human or now a dolphin or an elephant manages to see that. So this notion of seeing themselves and recognizing self somehow or another tells us something about what's going on in their mind, because if they recognize themselves, they must have some recognition of the other.
So now where does ignorance come into this? Because her studies seem to be designed quite differently, actually, from other people's.
So in her studies, for example, she uses the mirror that the animals get there's no fish reward. You know, they don't get a piece of food for looking in the mirror and doing something. She simply gives them the opportunity to utilize a mirror. There's some more work to do. I don't want to make it sound quite so casual. There's a lot of baseline data that's taken and a lot of observations that have to be done very carefully, of videos that are taken, and so that eventually when you get data, you can really make an honest assessment of it. But the procedure of the experiment is one of simply providing an opportunity for the animal, not forcing them to do anything, not making their behavior contingent on getting a reward or being fed or any of those other things, but rather let's see what the animal will do with this. As she puts it often, if you give the animals choice and control over their environment, they'll show us what they're thinking about and what they want. And if we're smart enough, we'll see it.
Well, and that's what I found so interesting, that her studies are less about finding the answer to a question and more about just trying to get a glimpse of something that would lead to more questions.
That's exactly right. So it's this idea of a glimpse that so attracts me to her work, and to that of other scientists too, because that's often all we get. But if we get the right glimpse and we're smart enough and we're conscious enough to recognize it for what it is, then it opens up a whole host of other kinds of questions that one can ask about. But the interesting thing about now knowing that dolphins recognize themselves in a mirror is that it opens up all these new questions. I mean, why would it develop in a dolphin? Why is it that animals that are separated by some 65 million years of evolutionary time from primates, why does it show up there again in this animal, but not in any of the intermediate sort of animals in an evolutionary scale? What does it mean? Can you now use it as a measure of something like empathy or other kinds of consciousness ideas? Does it increase our idea of consciousness? Does it expand our idea of consciousness now that we know that it's not just simply a human trait?
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. My guest is Stuart Feierstein, the author of Ignorance, How It Drives Science. And we have a very interesting question from the website from Tony.
Since scientific ideas are being constantly revised, how can we defend science against the claims that science doesn't matter, since it will change later anyway?
I guess the only thing I can say to that is that this idea of revision does not mean that it's unreliable. That equating revision with unreliability is, I think, a fundamental logical mistake. Because, again, the facts are true within the context in which they were first developed. It's not that things become so much wrong as that they simply need to be revised. I mean, maybe, you know, the famous example is that of so-called black swans. It was made famous in a book by Nassim Taleb called The Black Swan. So for many years, it was thought that swans were all white, and that was kind of the theory. You could say that was the hypothesis, swans are white. And then black swans were discovered, I think, in Australia, if I'm not mistaken. And so now things had to be changed. Now you could say, well, what does that mean? And the theory of white swans just goes out the window, and what's the use of it? And I would say, actually, it's kind of just the opposite. Now the data about white swans, or having observed so many white swans, actually becomes more interesting, because now we can ask ourselves a whole host of other questions that weren't there before. For example, if there are black swans, why is there such a preponderance of white swans? Is there an advantage to being a white swan over a black swan? And if there is an advantage, where is it and what is it? Why are black swans found primarily in Australia? What controls the color of swan feathers? Could swans come in other colors besides black and white, now that we know they come in at least two? So all of a sudden, there are all these questions that could never have even been asked if we just settled for all swans are white. But that doesn't change the data and the facts that were there when we didn't see a black swan yet. Those swans that were white are really white. That's a real fact. So I think that, again, the fundamental logical mistake is to equate uncertainty with unreliability. It's exactly the admission of uncertainty that gives science its power and why we should have confidence in it. If I can sneak this in very quick, there's a wonderful phrase by, I'll only have to paraphrase it, Václav Havel, who was the playwright, poet, and of course, first president of the Czech Republic, who said, follow those who seek the truth and flee from those who claim to have found it.
Well, and that makes me wonder then, does science have actual limits to what it can and cannot tell us?
This is a question that's debated constantly. I actually think the really the more important question from my perspective is, does our ignorance have limits? That's really, in some ways, the trickier question to ask. I don't know whether science has limits to what it, of course, there are limits to what it may be able to tell or not tell us, because there are certain things that we accept as being scientifically investigatable. I mean, in science, we don't ask why questions, for example. Why questions tend not to be worthwhile questions in science. You can ask how or what or where or when, but why questions often lead you down a kind of a rabbit hole and into a place where you can't develop data or can't think of experiments. So there may be some limits in that regard, but I'm not positive about that. I mean, maybe one day there won't be limits there. I'm not quite sure. The bigger question really to me is whether there are limits to our ignorance, whether there are things we'll never be able to figure out that we don't know. I find that in some ways more frightening. That we may not have the cognitive capacity to understand things, that to understand what we don't know, to know what we don't know, if you will.
So then when exactly does the uncertainty stop then? When is a fact final, I think is how you put it in your book.
Well, I don't think there is any point like that.
This is not reassuring, sir.
I'm sorry. I'm really sorry. So it's a curious thing, because when you do science, we kind of don't worry about this. I mean, I understand why it's worrisome to the public, I suppose, and it's hard to explain it, because when you do science, you don't worry about this. You go ahead, you get facts, you believe them for as long as they seem to be believable and worthwhile, and while they do the job, and when they stop doing the job or they need to be revised, you just revise them and you go on. And you don't look back and you don't worry about that. And you know that the ones you have now are probably going to be revised too, but you can get a little further along with the ones you have, and you have a slightly better view of things. And that's just kind of the way it works.
Well, then how can this help people? How can an understanding of the use of ignorance in science, how does that help people?
Well, I think it makes, in my view, it makes science more accessible. Because if all it is a pile of facts, and you have to memorize all these facts in order to be part of science, well, then nobody's ever going to be able to do that. And in particular, the general lay public, I think, won't be able to participate in, if you will, the adventure of science that's so fascinating to me for the last 14 generations of at least Western history. But I think if you ask, if the next time you're in the middle of a conversation with a scientist, instead of asking her what her work is about, you ask her what it is she's trying to figure out, you'll have a much more interesting conversation. Because if you let her go on about what her work is about, you know, she'll just bore your eyes right out of their sockets. That's what scientists are really good at doing if you're not careful. But if you ask what they're interested in, what their question is at the moment, what's got them riled up, what they're trying to figure out, then you'll really wind up with an interesting and understandable conversation.
It also might help people to not get all angry taxpayer when they hear about questionable research, maybe.
I think that's absolutely the case as well. There's a wonderful quote by Benjamin Franklin, of all people, our founding father, one of our founding fathers, who actually witnessed the first flight of human beings. He was at the time an ambassador to France, and he was in Paris. So the first time human beings lifted off the face of the earth actually was not in a fixed-wing aircraft, but in hot air balloons. And Franklin witnessed this, and a bystander at the time was next to him, said, gee, isn't this wonderful? This looks great. But really, what use do you think this could ever be? And Franklin turned to the fellow, and this is a well-documented story, by the way, turned to him and said, well, what use is a newborn baby? Now, that's kind of a little maybe extreme, but apparently that was Franklin's nature. But there's some truth to it. I mean, we don't really know what the use of a newborn baby is. We don't know how a baby's going to turn out, but we realize that it's worthwhile investing in them, because a few of them turn out to be pretty good. Many of them turn out to be just fine, and they all contribute something, it seems. So we invest in newborn babies even without knowing how it's going to go many, many years later. And science is very much like that, I think. We invest in it in the hope and the belief that it's taking us somewhere, and it often has.
Stuart, we're out of time, but thanks very much for being here.
Well, it was my pleasure, and I must say your audience has great questions.
You can find the link to Stuart Feierstein, the author of Ignorance, How It Drives Science, on our site at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, you are greatly encouraged to click the links to Twitter, Facebook, and Google Plus so that you can keep up with show news, and of course to iTunes, where you can download an episode or subscribe to the show or write a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, 'cause we're skeptically speaking.